This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The time is April 10th, 1987, when Michael J. Fox portrays a recent college graduate, Brantley Foster, who travels from his hometown in Kansas to New York City to pursue a new finance job. However, when Brantley arrives, he learns that his position has been eliminated, and he's forced to take a job working for his inept uncle, Howard, played by Richard Jordan, who became a company president through his marriage with Vera Prescott, played by Margaret Whitten. Brantley starts as a mere mailroom worker, but quickly manipulates his way up the corporate ladder when he begins posing as a made-up executive called Carlton Whitfield. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover a movie in the height of Michael J. Fox's career in The Secret of My Success.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
Now, Antonio, we have covered Michael J. Fox towards the end of the height of his career, an early episode with The Frighteners. Now I'm extremely excited to talk about this one in the middle of the height of his career. That's not Back to the Future. So this one, when I first watched this one as a kid, this one stood out as a Michael J. Fox favorite for me. This is the one that really made me discover Michael J. Fox. And that's not to say that Back to the Future was bad or I didn't like it. Of course, everybody honors it, praises it. I love Back to the Future. But this one with Michael J. Fox, and you know I love a good chaotic comedy. This one watching Michael J. Fox bounce from scene to scene in kind of a situational manner and just controlling the screen showed me a different kind of Michael J. Fox. And I'm going to put on my Antonio hat here for a second. During the rewatch, I could have torn this movie apart because it is absolutely flawed. But I absolutely appreciated this movie. And if I didn't see Michael J. Fox's documentary last year, still, I might have still torn this apart. But that documentary made me appreciate what went into this movie a little bit more. If I didn't see Still, I probably would tear this apart. But what I will say is there's no denying for me that this one is still stupid, but it is a lot of fun for me.
Okay, yeah, it's fun. And I did the rewatch. I'll go into my story in a second. But I didn't like this movie on the rewatch, but I also didn't hate it. I didn't trash it as much as our critics do. We'll get into that, of course, at the end of the episode. We all know how this works. What I think this is, personally, is I think this is, okay, so now we have to find something for Michael J. Fox to do that isn't Back to the Future. That, to me, is one of the biggest crimes against a talented actor that breaks big, like really on their first go, is they start getting locked into a particular type of character. And I feel that's why Michael J. Fox had a hard time finding success in leading roles after Back to the Future, because people just loved Marty McFly so much, right? That's the problem with this movie, is he is obviously trying to break free of the shackles of Marty McFly. And we see him do this with a few different films before, like, Back to the Future 2 comes out, you know? I mean, Teen Wolf technically was filmed first, but it came later after Back to the Future did. But, you know, when you think about the other movies that he was doing after this, like Doc Hollywood and For Love or Money, like, or Life with Mikey, it's always him trying to find what is the character that's right for him that's not Marty McFly. And for Michael J. Fox fans, I think we appreciate all his performances, but in the realm of cinema appreciation and of theater goers, I don't think they ever shook Marty McFly off of Michael J. Fox. This just happened to be the one where I think it was a little too ambitious. He was trying to shake it off a little too hard, and so it comes off a little bit forced. That being said, it's a fun 80s movie. It's got good 80s music. It's got great 80s people. I love Helen Slater and everything. For me, Richard Jordan is the bad guy from Logan's Run, you know, so I like that aspect to it. I love his aunt Prescott, Vera Prescott. You know, I like the characters in this movie, but I just don't really think it's a great movie. But it's fun. And like I always say, I'm on the fun bus. I don't have to think it's a fantastic movie to not understand how fun it actually is.
Yeah, it is a fun movie. And we look at Michael J. Fox here, and you're absolutely right. There is certain roles that he can do, and he's almost a stereotypical character in all these. I mean, we don't see him really sprout out until, I think, almost Life with Mikey, and then The Frighteners. So here, I think this is a sprout of him trying something more adult, but it's almost like an innocent PG Wolf of Wall Street that he's trying to portray here. And to me, I think when you're trying to make an origin story of your career and sprout out with kind of the bare bones basics, I think this one, he does a fantastic job on the comedic timing without changing who he is. And one problem I have with Michael J. Fox is he never really changes his range in his performance. He never really goes for that star-studded role. He sticks to what he's comfortable with and he knows. But this is what I appreciate about this kind of movie going into it. This is a time in his career that he was pumping out 2 to 3 movies a year on top of Family Ties. So to me, given this kind of performance with how many projects he has, I got to look up to this guy. And that's where my appreciation comes, is I still find this performance memorable with how many projects he took on, because we can even see it in the detail of the movie, where his hair changes colors throughout the movie because he was doing makeup in the car on the way from Family Ties to this. So there is a lot of hard work that he did in this. And that's kind of where it's hard, where I'm going to really contradict myself when it comes to critiquing movies, is this one steered me in a biased direction to really appreciate the details of it, in terms of just kind of ignoring the flaws, if that makes sense.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying. I don't have as much emotional attachment to Michael J. Fox. I love the dude, but I've always thought him more of a great television actor. You know, like I really, of course, Alex B. Keaton, and then Spin City. Like that was, to me, the perfect role for him. When I say that he was trying to shake off Marty McFly, well, look at the run of films that he had in between this and Back to the Future 2. This is, I'm not going to say it's a dark film, but the characters, including his own, are despicable, but they're supposed to be, because that's the story. It's an 80s yuppie comedy, which Gene calls out right away, and he's 100% right. We talked about it in our Bad Influence episode, right? Where it's like, Gene does have a disposition of not liking yuppie films where there's no like character redemption to these people, where they're all just kind of shallow, money-hungry, self-absorbed people. That's literally everybody in this movie. Fox doubles down in Bright Lights, Big City. He doubles down on that. And it's a good movie, and Kiefer's in it, and they're both kind of dark, but it's doubling down on that darkness. And then he goes the full extent and does Casualties of War right after that. So you have 3 films that just keep going darker and heavier, darker and heavier, darker and heavier, until he's brought back into the light with Back to the Future 2 and 3. He didn't necessarily go that route again after. I think he learned his lesson. I think he learned his range. And of all 3 of those movies in between, I think Casualties of War is his best performance. It's a flawed movie, to be sure. I think it's Sean Penn's fault. That movie rubs me the wrong way because everything else about that movie I like. But Sean Penn's fucking accent in the movie just drives me up the wall. But then once he realizes, okay, that's not who I am, and he gets the Back to the Futures out of the way, well, then we get the charming films like Life with Mikey and Doc Hollywood. You know, like those are the fun latter-day films of Michael J. Fox that I actually enjoy. I'm not a big fan of like this more dangerous period, but like you said, God bless him for trying to find his range, for him to find what kind of actor he can be. Because I mean, I'm sure he was getting all sorts of scripts sent his way, and he was probably very selective of like, okay, I don't want to be 20-something years old playing a teenager forever. I want to play a goddamn grown-up for once. And this is what he's trying to do, you know?
Well, and this is where I think this is going to be the episode where I say but a lot. And but. It's going to contradict myself. Like, all my shows, I have my but episodes, right? But this one is definitely going to be a but. But let's look at this. So when we look at critiquing a movie, does the movie execute what the director and the writers are trying to go for? This knows exactly. This is where I'm going to go on defense of this movie, because look at director Herbert Ross, who did a lot of fun and emotional movies that go to the core of touching somebody in the audience to really connect with, to really either have fun, be a tearjerker, or just really kind of be lighthearted. So, I mean, we have My Blue Heaven in the early 90s, Steel Magnolias, one of my personal guilty pleasures, Undercover Blues. So the director takes on these projects to really connect with an audience on the fun factor. Then we add in writers, Jim Cash and Jack Epps of Top Gun, Turner and Hooch, Dick Tracy. All these are fun movies that really kind of mimic what The Secret to My Success is really trying to do. So yeah, it's unbelievable. Yeah, it's kind of far-fetched. And yeah, we kind of get these cartoonist sitcom scene cuts. But to me, I think that's part of the fun factor of what these filmmakers were trying to do. And it would be a shame for me to ignore just the purpose of what they want to bring and show to an audience or a viewer watching this movie. Because our critics are going to say it later in the show, where they're going to talk about the woulda, coulda, shouldas. And to me, the woulda, coulda, shouldas don't work in their perception. So to me, this vision does work. But again, flawed on some pieces of the execution on how they get to that vision.
Well, I can't agree with you on all that, because I'm a huge Herbert Ross fan of everything but this. I mean, first of all, he did a plethora of Neil Simon movies, and we both, you know, have different feelings about Neil Simon as a writer. But he also was really, really good at doing like interpersonal comedies and relationship movies, like Owl and the Pussycat. My personal favorite of his is a Neil Simon movie that no one can find right now because it's not on DVD. VHSs are expensive, and that's Max Dugan Returns. It's actually on the list coming up soon. You can still find it on YouTube and stuff like that, but it was like one of Matthew Broderick's first roles, and it does a great job of telling family stories and characters that you actually want to like, even though there are a lot of complications to their backstory, whether it's a criminal thing, whether it's like, oh, I cheated on your mom 20 years ago, can you forgive me? This is where I think Herbert Ross actually saves the movie, because the script does not match the people saying the words. Helen Slater does not work in this role for me. She's great. I love her, but she doesn't fit this character. This character is supposed to be like ball busting, ambitious businesswoman. She plays it like the role she plays in Ruthless People, like the fragile wife who can't even like hold the gun without shaking it. Like, that's how she plays this movie. So it doesn't come off right. Michael J. Fox doesn't come off right, because yeah, he's got like the ego and the attitude and the self-assurance, but he also, you have to put aside that disbelief that he comes with this sensuality that's irresistible to other women. It doesn't really work for me. So who's going to save the movie when the script doesn't match the characters saying the lines? It's the director. And how do you do that? By making your scenes tight, by not hanging too long on a scene where you are just not going to be able to have that suspension of disbelief that someone actually wants to bang Michael J. Fox several times a day. You keep it going. You keep it fast-paced, almost like 1950s farce. And that's what Herbert Ross does the best. He's like, okay, I'm going to weave a tapestry of scenes that are going to be fun and entertaining, and we're going to keep it moving before people can catch up to us and realize that the movie's kind of bullshit.
I'd agree with that. And when it comes to Helen Slater here, I thought she did a good job for what she had, but I think where the problem landed was the chemistry and the way the characters between her and Fox were written. Because at one point towards the second act or in the middle of the second act, we get that transition that just doesn't fit. It's this purely strict businesswoman, and then all of a sudden it's a snap of the fingers and they're in love.
Like so literally in an 8-hour period.
Yeah, that is one of the many flaws of this movie that just doesn't work. And when they're together, it's not believable. That's my biggest complaint with that. But I love the fact that you brought back those old goofy comedies, because here's where I think was a missed opportunity. One of my favorite scenes, and it's not because it's well directed or choreographed, is the typical 80s song with the doors opening, closing during the party scene. I love that element to this movie, but what I hated about it is that it was the wrong setting. It's too claustrophobic to really take advantage of getting that fun factor feel, because it feels like the camera is being shoved in a small crevice to get a shot at a kind of a low angle shot. And we're not taking advantage of the comedic timing on this. So I think there are a lot of small directorial issues that we have with it, but I think he did the best with what he had. But I think the biggest problem in a lot of these scenes is too many music montage that is huge in the 80s that really kind of move the story along without any dialogue. That's a sloppiness, even though I think they're a lot of fun. But here, I think they could have limited a lot of the romance aspect of it and just made it a little bit more taboo, because we get hints of this in the beginning with Michael J. Fox sleeping with his aunt. And I don't know what it is about 80s movies and sleeping with family members, but we kind of get hints at that, but it doesn't go far enough and it doesn't really transition well. So I think stick to the risque of the taboo element, get rid of the romance, and find a way to work with the characters that we have, and just have that stern character be a stern character from start to finish and have that comedic timing on where she's placed throughout. I think that would have really made that big of a difference in this film.
I mean, it could have. And I think the movie doesn't do itself any favors by borrowing very, very recognizable and influential 80s music. You know, we've got the Yellow Oh Yeah song playing like three times. Well, that's Ferris Bueller's song. I'm sorry, no matter what, that will always be Ferris Bueller's song. In fact, I was watching this with my partner and she's like, haven't we heard all these songs in the movies? I'm like, yes, it's a problem. And it was a problem. It was distracting to me that I'm like, oh my God, like every single recognizable song except for the theme song, the main song, Secret of My Success, which is a banger, everything else is lifted from some other popular movie of the time. So yeah, I think one of the biggest issues I have with this movie is going back to thinking about what it's trying to be. So how I first saw this movie was when I was in junior high school, we did a production of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And I was Pierpont. I was Ponty. I was J. Pierpont Finch. And to prepare for the role, because I'd seen the original, right, with Robert Morris, great movie, I remember hearing that there was an 80s remake and that it was this. I'm like, okay, well, I'll watch that. Well, it's not. I mean, there is an ambitious guy that starts in the mailroom, and that's pretty much it. Pierpont Finch doesn't sleep with his aunt or try to, like, finagle the company away from his third uncle, whatever, how they make the connection of the family lineage. But that's how I first saw it, and I wasn't really impressed, and I hadn't seen it again until we watched it just now. And I was more impressed by the things that you're championing, right? Like, I could see how this would be a Justin movie. But at the same time, when I go back now and listen to the critiques of Siskel and Ebert, I can't disagree. But there's been plenty of movies where I can agree with them on the total package of the critique, but I still think there's fun to it. For me, there's not enough fun to make this a winner or a shelf-worthy item, or if I'll even watch it again. But I appreciate everybody's effort in the movie. I appreciate all the performances. I think they were good. For me, the two winners of the movie is Aunt Vera. She's fantastic. And then John Pankow as the other guy in the mailroom who kind of like helps him get through his quick costume changes throughout the movie and keep his secrets and stuff like that. John Pankow is always a great sidekick. Like, he's a great sidekick in To Live and Die in L.A., and he's a great sidekick in this. So I was happy to see him. Those were my two favorite characters, but that's the problem. And we've talked about this in many movies. When the side characters become the people that you want more of, then your movie's got a problem, because I was anticipating the next time Aunt Vera showed up, because everyone else is just so dull. And the businessmen, that was a missed opportunity. Of every time going into one of those conference rooms, there should have been a quirky character for each one of those guys that had a line. But the only quirky character is just the one dude that keeps getting like put down upon. Like, oh, Richards, Richards, why can't you be more like him? That guy. It was the perfect opportunity to bring more comedy into this. Instead, they went with a very stereotypical, bland business setting, which I get works if you're trying to pump up Michael J. Fox's performance, but you're also just letting the air out of the film when you put us through those moments where we're waiting for someone to do something. You get what I'm saying?
100%. And again, I love it when you give out participation trophies. It's my favorite part of the show.
You got to do it.
But but I love the fact that you brought up the boardroom scenes, because that is another element that I think is completely missed when it comes to comedy. We get a suggestion at the table and everybody in unison just nods their head and goes, yeah, and then nothing comes from that. And it's a perfect opportunity from a great comedic moment. And especially if we add some personality to these people, because we know we get kind of snippets of some scenes, especially at the party scene, where we do get a little bit of personality, but it's like one piece of dialogue that's like two sentences, and we don't really have much from these guys. We just get them placed like props. And that's where the biggest piece of where I wanted more of the chaotic comedy to come from, because we have a crap ton of characters here and we really don't do anything. This has a huge list of extras, but it's a missing element. So this could have been pure comedic gold, utilizing the characters in the background and not spotlighting just per se Michael J. Fox. But mm-hmm. Aunt Vera, you're 100% right. She overpowers everybody on screen, because I bought her as a corporate type more than anybody else. And she rarely talks business except for that final scene at the end, where she comes in with the biggest amount of confidence in a boardroom to take over that meeting. And even when Michael J. Fox, you can tell there's a little uncomfortability to it, because he has to compete with Aunt Vera at this point on performance, because she is just nailing every single line. And it's like Michael J. Fox is raising his hand saying, pay attention to me, or I need to move faster, or I need to talk quicker. So there's a competition between dialogue, and that's where we lose a little bit of the credibility, even more so on that final act.
Agreed. I mean, well, they do the big business ending, which, you know, any business-based comedy of the 80s had to have that particular ending. But I tell you what, the hardest I laughed in the movie is when he accidentally goes into his uncle's office and she's there and she puts him in a half Nelson and like twists him around and throws him on the couch. All of that physical business was the funniest part of the movie to me, and I was literally dying laughing. And I wanted more of that. Not necessarily just that kind of scene. I wanted more of those kind of laughs, right? And they just don't come enough. Now, speaking about like business settings and making characters unique and funny and outlandish and making even the smallest character important, well, the Coens nailed it in Hudsucker Proxy, which is kind of a similar story. A guy that starts in the mailroom and like wakes his way up. Different motivations, but that's how you do it. I mean, the guy who just says, including the mezzanine, that's his only line. And it's a banger because the character delivery is so unique and outlandish. That's such a Coen thing. I wanted more of that because, okay, this is the thing. And I think they kind of mention it in the review too. It doesn't know how funny it actually wants to be. The movie doesn't know. Does it want to be a slap happy farcical comedy, or does it want to kind of stay in that realm of kind of comedic satire business drama? Like, we're making fun of the Wall Street elites and how bullshit everything is, and the kid from Kansas can sneak into an office and run a company better than the key people have been there for 20 years can. Well, yeah, we know that already. So why are we like putting so much focus on the business acumen and less on this? Someone throw a fucking pie. Like, this is a comedy. Make me laugh. God damn it.
If they whipped out a pie at some point in this movie, I'm sure that would have been the cherry on top for me. But here's where I think the problem is we talked about the setting earlier, and I think we see that throughout the movie, because how do we balance, how do we make a corporate building with thousands of employees funny? How do we make an executive sound funny or act funny and still carry that professionalism and believability? But that's where the movie does fail, is because we don't get any of it. It's not too dark. It's not too slapstick.
Right.
It kind of teeters in the safe realm of not knowing where to go. It plays it safe. It plants all the seeds of what it wants to be with the relationship with the aunt, between the affair from the executives. So all this stuff is there. It reminded me of a remade French comedy from the 50s and the 60s, taken over and just demolished and torn out pages from the original script and adapted, that we see so many times from American adaptions. So that's what it reminded me, to an extent, of taking out all the funny things or the edgy things and just putting in the stale elements.
Okay, so I hate you, because I was going to say the same thing, but that really coincides more with my movie for next week. So I was going to save it for next week, but we may as well talk about it now. 100%. There is so much European influenced comedy here, like the potential incest and stuff like that. That's so European, but it's not played far enough. It's not given enough heavy handedness to it to not make it feel like it's been watered down. And that's what it feels like. The movie feels watered down, where it's like, okay, make this a hard R, you know? And then make it a hard R like Trading Places, right? Like, bring us that kind of energy. Bring us how shitty these rich people really are. Don't try and neuter it. And I think that's why the wind just gets blown out of the sails for it for me, is that it feels like a neutered attempt at something that could have been really, really good and funny if they would have just gone all the way. Like if this was a Paul Bartel movie, right? Like if this was like an Eating Raoul style or the Bourgeoisie style, you know, something like that, I think it would have been a lot better. But at the same time, it's a Michael J. Fox thing, and I don't think they were ready to put that face on that package quite yet.
100% right, because whether or not this movie was written for Michael J. Fox with an intent, that could have watered it down as well,
right?
Because studios are going to get scared when you take a Back to the Future Teen Wolf star and put him in a hard R, taboo, incest, corporate environment. So that's going to scare studios away. So to me, that could have worked, but not with Michael J. Fox.
No.
He doesn't have the range.
Patrick Dempsey or Rob Lowe, 100%. That would have been in the right frame, too, of time when they could have done that. You got these two guys that were perfectly comfortable of doing that kind of comedy, and people were comfortable seeing them do that kind of comedy. But Marty McFly can't just go around fucking the aunt. Like, you can't do it. Like, I get it. I get it 100%.
Hey, coffee lovers, Antonio and Justin of Back to the Balcony here, and we've got something special for you. If you're looking to start your day with the perfect boost, you need to try Bulletproof Coffee. This isn't your average cup of joe. It's packed with high-quality ingredients designed to fuel your body and mind. Whether you're powering through a workout, tackling a busy workday, or just need the extra edge, Bulletproof Coffee has got you covered. And guess what? We've teamed up with Bulletproof to give you an exclusive deal. Use code B2B, that's B the number 2B, at checkout to save 20% on your order. That's right, 20% off just for being a loyal listener. So don't wait, head over to Bulletproof's website and experience the difference yourself. Your mornings will never be the same with Bulletproof Coffee. Thank you for listening, and now back to the show.
So our critics, man, this might be the saltiest critique that we've played in the 30-something episodes that we've been going. We've heard one guy be really salty, that one kind of defend it, but rarely do we hear them both jump on the bandwagon. Beetlejuice, they at least had some good things to say about it. The art direction, the costumes, the set design. They tore this one apart. So let's go ahead and play that now.
Our next movie is named The Secret of My Success, and it stars Michael J. Fox in a very disappointing, recycled, dumb stupid version of some of those high-rise office sitcoms from the 1950s. Fox plays a kid from Kansas who moves to New York and talks his uncle into hiring him as a lowly clerk in the mailroom. But Fox has loftier ambitions, and when he discovers an empty office, he moves into it and adopts a fictitious second identity as a new executive. That means he has to keep hiding in the elevator, changing names and clothes.
Okay, so let's go to the beginning of the movie, because I totally forgot about this from the original watch, you know, decades ago. I was kind of on board right from the start where they kind of break the fourth wall and they have like the family members talking to the camera about what could happen to him in New York City and why do you got to go, you know, stay here in Kansas with us. There's plenty of good schools, plenty of good businesses. And I was instantly drawn to that kind of energy because like, okay, I like this because they're setting me up for something that's not so cookie cutter as what we've seen in the past. Like there's a little bit of avant-garde-ness to it. And I kind of liked that. But they don't do anything like that the rest of the movie. It's just there. So number one, that teaser of me expecting something bigger from this movie pissed me off. When he's talking about like the dumb, the stupid, unintelligent things like that, that's a very easy thing to say because yes, it's 100% that. And yes, it does borrow heavily from, you know, things we've seen in the past, you know, those 30s, 40s, you know, rise to the top office movies like The Front Page or How to Succeed. But I think the biggest issue that he's kind of getting at before they go into it more that I am taking a personal issue with the film is that it's just not smart enough. It's just not smart enough to keep me entertained and to believing that he can pull this off. That really pissed me off was the laziness and the stupidity of the characters in the office building, with the exception of his mailroom boss, who's the only one that has any suspicion that he's doing something shady or stupid. I mean, I get it if we're making like a satirical play on how dumb the corporate world and the finance world is, but yes, we all know that, like I said. But literally, he gets away with so much, and it's so blatantly obvious that he would not be getting away with it, but they don't even attempt to make any kind of clever play on how and why he is able to get away with it for so long. That really pissed me off. I let the movie take me on the fun bus, but that aspect right there really, really pissed me off.
So I'm going to go the opposite side of it, and it's going to make me feel completely stupid, and I know this, but I'm going to say it anyway, is I was kind of bought in to the way he did, because they showed how he did it, and if we go back to the 80s, I can buy into a little bit of, okay, he's part of the mailroom, he's dropping off instructions of how to pull this off, I get that, okay, I can buy that, but then we get into the elevator where I question, why doesn't he just go to the restroom and change his clothes? So we get those tiny elements that drove me nuts. But at the same time, I enjoyed those little scenes because they're fun. They make no sense whatsoever. And you question it. But at the same time, it's there. You know it's there, put in for fun. And that's where I have to agree with both of them. It is stupid, but I don't know. I don't care. I liked that piece of it.
It's fine to not care.
But I think, to me, the believability to it, I think it had something. It just didn't focus more on it because we have a lot of useless scenes that really took away from how he actually did pull it off. And if it was any other movie, any other movie that's well-written, I should say, he would have been caught within the first like 30, 45 minutes of before the end of the second act. So to me, I think there are a lot of missed elements to it. But I think, again, I go back to the intent. And I think they knew exactly the writers cannot see the holes in this movie and say, just forget about it, because we have solid writers here.
We do have solid writers here. I don't know what happened in rewrites. But at the same time, I mean, a year later, we have Big come out, right? And Big was able to play that fish out of water person who doesn't belong in this corporate environment. And the naivete of that person is what leads them to be in a much larger role than they should be. But it's done brilliantly. The way that they map that out and structure it out, where the brilliance of it is that he's not even trying. Like, essentially, he's failing into success. And that's the whole point of that. That's a great way to make that kind of contradiction of, you know, corporate intelligence, right? This movie doesn't do that. It's like, okay, well, this kid who's never worked in a building before, it's his first job out of college, yet he knows how to operate the hallways of an office building and a mailroom. He knows how to find business memos. Like I said, I got on the fun bus, but you're not going to turn off my analytical brain here, man.
And I guess if I were to say in defense, and I don't even know why I'm defending it because I know this is a horrible movie, but if I were to go on defense, I would say this almost borders satire. And you touched on it a little bit earlier, where we have the corporate board members that kind of just, we talk about them nodding their heads in agreement to everything. They just kind of go along with everything. And I think that's part of the comedy, but I think it's an inside joke because I think the writers thought it looked a lot funnier on paper than how it was executed.
Well, I totally, because yeah, I believe that 100%.
Because I think there are a lot of nuggets here, but throughout the movie that shows how to represent the corporate world. And they thought that was going to be funny enough. And it just ended up bland. And we can point that to the fault of the director as well. But at the same time, if you can't find it funny when it comes to a line and just head motions and then just situations, then it's not going to be funny on the presentation aspect.
Well, I mean, also too, it's like they nailed that exact same environment in Putney Swope as well in the opening scene in the conference room. But I think the reason why that scene is so hilarious is because everyone's kind of improvising. You got Alan Garfield in there improvising. Everyone's kind of quirky. It's the exact same setting and everyone's like nodding like, oh, you're going to put this guy in charge of the company. But that created that environment and that sense of comedy because it wasn't trying to be stereotypical, because it wasn't trying to, like, maybe the film is directed and maybe that scene is written for people that actually work in that corporate world and they would find it funny. But the rest of us are just like, well, where's the funny? You know, we're waiting for it. So maybe it is directed at a very certain audience. I don't want to go off in too many tangents, but I think that's also why Wall Street was a huge hit in the 80s, because even people that didn't understand the world of finance and corporate takeovers, it was put in layman terms enough for us to understand it, but it was really written for the people that were doing it, right? And even though it was a cautionary tale, guys in that industry looked at it as if it was like, oh, they're making a movie about us. This is what we fucking do. It became like gospel to them. Maybe that's what this was trying to do and just did not achieve it, you know?
Well, it's almost like they had to pivot with the cast that they had. They're like, yeah, all right, this corporate world, we have Michael J. Fox. How do we make him look like a big boy on screen and talk like a salesman? So it's like they put all their money with Michael J. Fox and they didn't know what to do with it. They're like, all right, this kid looks 12 and
he's so cute in his little suits and dance.
He was. There was the elevator scene when they're Slater and him are arguing about finding out about
and
who
he's like
he really
looking
is.
Up at her.
He's looking up and he's chasing her like at half the size. So at that point, I knew the chemistry wasn't working and I knew I wasn't bought in. But it took that exact moment to say, all right, I get it. It's ridiculous.
When I was watching it, I was almost reminded me of the Force perspective they use when Frodo's talking to Gandalf. You know, like Gandalf is like 6 feet closer to the camera than Frodo is. And I was just like, oh, my God, this looks like forced perspective, but it's not. She's like literally 5 inches taller than he is. Anyway, they go on.
The secret to my success is never believable, but that'd be okay if it were only funny. The problem is nobody connected with this movie seems to have given a moment's thought to the real fear and greed and ambition and lust that exists in a big company and that could have had some possibilities. Everything is played in this movie for predictable, telegraphed slapstick. A lot of opportunities are missed. I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, this is Michael J. Fox.
Yes.
This is directed by Herbert Ross.
Stunning.
These are people associated with quality. How did they get involved with this movie, which is nowhere?
Telegraph, that's like the perfect analogy. Like there is just so much telegraphed, Morse code, monotone, predictable moments in this movie, which is why characters like John Pankow and like Vera show up and save the day. I mean, even in the climax, which, like you said, what a missed opportunity that was, too. I mean, very Neil Simon and very, you know, Noel Coward, British farce, doors open, doors closed, mistaken identities, like, you know, Clue does that great. But this did not work in this movie. Like, the tension wasn't there. And they bring in that one weird dude from The Office, too, that makes no sense when she accidentally goes into his room and he's like, oh, she wants me. And then he follows her and nothing makes sense. Again, it's like that whole thing was literally just phoned in. It's like, this worked in this movie and this worked in this movie, so let's do a scene like that. But there was no investment in that scene, right? Like, the telegraph analogy to me, I think, is a perfect example.
Yeah, it was an 80s scrapbook of movies, because even when we get to that last scene, and again, we talk about transitions, that was another transition that made no sense because it was too quick. They needed a quick resolve. And that one, we even had that the mailroom coworker that made no sense, because he just kind of appears after maybe 3-4 other times appearing in the movie. So, and he's just all of a sudden an executive. So to me, the transitions just are too quick and they don't make sense. And again, like they said, there's a lot in this movie that doesn't make sense. And I think a lot of it is they don't go far enough, or they don't finish it, or they don't finish a train of thought, because they have to make almost check marks to reach a certain runtime, it feels like.
Yeah. So this is the perfect example of the economy of storytelling in a film like this, where they literally are picking and choosing the moments they think are going to be most appreciated by the audience, therefore probably cutting out or not even shooting things that would have actually made the story more believable, or made these characters, I'm not going to say likable, because I don't think they're supposed to be likable, but at least when they do get, let's say, their resolution, or if there is a moment of, why can't I think of words tonight? Whether it's like the resolution or their moments of redemption, because they're so shitty throughout the movie, when it gets there, we really don't care. Like, they go from hating each other and calling each other like sluts and whores to a ride in the elevator and they're making out. Like, oh, it all got solved in an elevator ride to the third floor, right? I didn't buy it, but I got on the bus and I let the bus take me. Also, this has a very similar ending to Bonfire of the Vanities, which we just covered last week. I was like, shit, it's essentially like the same ending where all of a sudden we're the elites now, right?
And again, I criticize that ending, but this one I'm not going to criticize because it's a butt episode. But this one, let's look at even Christy and Vera, where just in a previous scene, they were calling bimbo, bitch, slut, whatever it may be. And then all of a sudden, they're in the boardroom, firing everybody and taking charge of the company. So we're missing even a scene there to tell us what happened, what
we are.
Switch was flicked to make these characters get along all of a sudden. So, and it starts right from that transition of them making out in the elevator. It's like that was a symbol to from the filmmaker saying, ignore everything behind the curtain, viewers. Everybody's going to get along from this point on.
Yeah, that part pissed me off. And I'm so glad that you brought it up, because literally we are missing that scene of like everyone gets locked in a closet or locked in a room and they have to fight it out, right? And that's where they come up with this plan. Big Business did it in a great way. I can't believe I'm defending that movie, but they did it. They showed you how they were going to save the day. And in this one, they literally go from calling each other sluts and whores and slapping each other, and to instantly, this is how we're going to save the company. We miss a whole chunk. I agree with you 100%.
Well, we should also, even if they added like another, like the fifth or fourth music montage of them just in a room writing out a plan, I would have been satisfied with that.
This movie is staggeringly bad. There is not a moment of excitement. There is not a laugh. Dumb situation comedies. I really don't want to see Michael Fox roll around on a couch with an older woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a bad version of The Graduate. Mm-hmm. This movie is a bad version of a lot of the teen comedies. It's a bad yuppie movie. It's a movie that has no moral values. We expect with Michael Fox to have him question the values of the company he's trying to succeed in. What stuns me in this year is that we get a movie about a kid who's willing to just climb the corporate ladder, and it doesn't even comment on that. It just does it for comedy.
Or they could have even made it cynical.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
They could have made it, he was cynical about his success.
success. He was cynical about the lack of values in the company. This movie absolutely buys it.
Yes.
You know, let's get to the top, and if I get there, that's good.
And
no matter who I have to hurt, no matter who I have to stand
or
on.
Or what products the company makes.
That's right.
This is a
that's
sick
right.
little
in
movie.
In fact, what products did that company
who
make?
Who cares?
I can't remember.
I agree with him 100%, especially Roger, when he talks about, oh, take the cynical approach. That's what How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying does. Like, Pierpont Finch is reading the little book about how to get ahead quickly. And it's all based on how stupid and structured, and it's not the skill, but it's how much you're willing to brown nose and kiss ass to get to the top. So do that, and do that in certain ways, and you'll get to the top. The cynicism of that movie is what makes it comedy. There's none of that in here. They try, like they put a little, you know, dot of it here and there, but they don't follow through because you're interrupted with, you know, Richard Jordan coming in and trying to sleep with his, you know, executive. Like, there's so many distractions in this movie that takes it away from what I think they were looking for. But also, man, Gene says something that's really interesting as well, too, about, you know, he doesn't want to see Michael J. Fox fooling around with his aunt and this and that. If there's one thing that I don't want to criticize Michael J. Fox on in his performance, because maybe it wasn't his choice, but one of the things that makes Marty McFly so likable is how visually surprised, stunned, and scared he is of all the things that happened to him. And Zemeckis knows how to capture that. Just pushes the camera right into his face when he's like, oh my God, Doc, you know, he is visually stunned. There are moments in this movie where he should be visually stunned, but he doesn't put out any emphasis in his reactions. For example, when he finds out he's sleeping with his aunt, it's like, oh my God, you're my aunt. He's like, oh, so that would make you my aunt. Like, the energy wasn't there. And maybe that's just because we were so spoiled to what he did with Marty McFly that we were expecting more from him in this. So again, maybe that's Herbert Ross saying, hey, tone it down. We're not Back to the Future. Or that's him saying, I need to be more mature. I can't be like that screaming kid in Hill Valley in 1955. I'm a businessman now, you know? It's just a really weird dynamic, a really weird energy for me.
Yeah, and again, this is where I think he's really testing his range, and I don't think this was a movie that was ready for him, because nobody really asked for a confident Michael J. Fox. We wanted that underdog. We wanted that kind of that boy next door. And then the moments where he starts to spout off confidence in this movie is where his performance starts to lack a little bit. We don't get that boy next door, and it seems kind of out of place. But this is what, even though I do agree to an extent with our critics, this is where I'm going to kind of nitpick their critique on it, is we've heard this time and time again of any time we have, especially a comedy, that doesn't work. They always, in almost every review that they can, tie in an executive, be sinister, or attack the corporate ladder, whatever it may be. They always go to a darker comedy. So my question would be, is why do we always have to have a corporate, even though it is the easy scapegoat to make it very dislikable? Why can't we have a movie where it's just okay just to make it goofy, even though this one might not be executed flawlessly? But we see that pattern with Siskel and Ebert, where if they don't like the comedy in something, they want it sinister. They want it dark. They want the kind of the satire just really shoved down our throats. That's the comedy, and that's the movie that they kind of want. And we've seen it time and time again. When they get it, they don't like it. So to me, I hate it when they bring that into a review, because it's always contradicting.
And at the end of the day, what it comes down to with this movie is, either you watched it and liked it, or you watched it and hated it. I didn't hate this movie, but I knew it wasn't a good movie. But there's enough that I recognize, and I like Michael J. Fox, and I liked the laughs that it did give me. But at the same time, I was fully aware from scene one till that stupid closing ending credits. I was like, it's not a good movie, but I watched it. I could probably watch it again. I didn't hate it, but I recognized it for what it was. But then again, I'm not the one who's on TV writing critiques or reviews. I mean, in my Letterboxd review, I'm not going to tell you how many stars I got, but essentially my brief synopsis of the review is, it's an 80s movie. What more do you want? Did you laugh? Then it did its job. Like, that's what it is. It is comfort food, right? It's macaroni and cheese. You're not going to go order at the nicest restaurant. You're not going to be blown away by it. But hey, give me another bowl. It was fun, you know?
It is an 80s movie. And this is one of those movies that when it's on TV, I know it's bad. And I'm still going to watch it because it is just mindless and it's mindless entertainment where it will get you through the journey. Is it going to make you think afterwards? Is it going to make you go back and remember a joke that was told? No, I don't even remember a joke after the three rewatches this week. But I do remember moments in this movie enough to say, you know what? That made me feel good. That made me feel like I can really connect with this movie on an entertainment level. Movies and comedies don't have to give you belly laughs. They don't even have to make you laugh. But if they kind of make you feel good and get you through the journey, then that's a win. But this movie could have been a lot better. There's no doubt about that. But to me, I think this movie is going to be one of my guilty pleasures on my list because I can appreciate it for what it is and what it tried to do, and especially with the work that was put into it, even though flawed.
You know what this movie needed? Because it's an 80s movie and it did not have it, it lacked it, and I think that's why it just kind of has fallen off of the radar for a lot of people who enjoy 80s films. It didn't have a moment, right? 80s films all had a moment. If we think Ferris Bueller, we think the parade scene, you know, Shake It Up Baby. Or if we're thinking The Breakfast Club, well, it's probably like the dance scene or the huddle up and, you know, all cry together scene. Like, there's moments in all these 80s movies. This movie did not have a moment for me to say, oh, remember in The Secret of My Success when there's none of that. It doesn't have a particular moment that's going to stand out. And if you're going to be an 80s comedy, and that was the formula of that decade, is you had to have, I mean, your movie could be shit. You know, like Revenge of the Nerds, panty raid scene, or Lambda Lambda and Omega Mu. Like, those are memorable moments that they're mediocre movies at best, but they got moments that are going to get parodied on fucking Family Guy or brought up in, you know, some obscure comedy sketch or Saturday Night Live. No one's going to bring anything out of this movie because it did not have a moment. And that is, I think, the filmmakers and writers' fault for thinking that they can compete with films in 1987 of all years to not have a moment for the audience.
I love that you brought that up because it attempts a moment, but it is so subtle and it defines this movie on the laziness of it because the moment is no dialogue. It's that music montage at the party and Brantley is going over his plans, but you have no idea. He's just waving his hands and talking. And Vera gives him...
And all the rich guys
and they're just going along with it. And then you have Vera give a look. The look was supposed to be this moment for this transition for this movie. And that is a good sign that there's no effort put into trying to do this moment. Cause I always go back to the Rocketeer and their moment where you have the Nazi or the gangsters and the cops working together and you get that go get 'em kid moment. So that even if you have something so cheesy for this movie, just to kind of define what it wants to be, it takes one sentence to really change a movie and change an outlook on the direction of perception. And that's what this is missing. And they try and do it with something so lazy as just a look from the best actress of the movie.
I think we solved the movie's problem. We're 40 years too late, but but we figured it out. Okay, so, you know, it's an interesting thing now to try and put a rating on our critics' reviews because they are definitely coming from a place of emotion here. Like, they despise this movie so much. And there is a lot to despise, especially if, like, they went out, like you said last week, if they went out of their way to go see it, they had to arrange their schedules, and this is the movie they're seeing tonight, and oh my God, what is going on with this movie? I can feel the angst in their voices and on their faces as they're talking about it. So how does that come up with like the justifiability of their critique? Well, for Gene, since it wasn't his movie to bring to the episode, I feel he was just echoing and repeating pretty much everything that Roger said first. And that happens a lot. Roger was always a lot more eloquent than Gene. So when Roger goes first, Gene pretty much just kind of recycles the things, unless they're having a debate about the thing. So I think that the movie's a C minus. I'm going to say that the critique is a C minus.
Even though this is going to be my guilty pleasure, but I think Roger is spot on in all of his points. So it's hard to argue when you know he's right with about so much.
It's true. It's the biggest thing about this podcast that I didn't realize that I'd be saying pretty much every other week or every third week is like, he's right. And I don't want him to be right, but he's so
right. And the frustration I can tell, and this, they put emotion, especially Roger, into this one because he even says it in his review. It has a great director. It has great writers. So there's a lot to set this movie up for success in his eyes. But walking in, they don't know where the talent went. So to me, his emotion is justified in disappointment on the talent involved. So, I mean, with him, he made valid points. He articulated it brilliantly. I got to get him 3 stars.
Yeah, I think that's great. His synopsis and his review was a lot more eloquent and thoughtful than what Gene put out as like his retort. Also, in the written review, he gave it 1.5 stars and just trashed it. Like, I haven't read so much spiciness in so long, especially in any of the films that we've covered for him. So, and it's funny because like we just released our Guilty Pleasures episode this week that we're recording this, and some of the movies that he considers his guilty pleasure, I was like, man, they dodged a bullet because I just read the review for Secret of My Success and it's harsh.
It's hard. You have to find at least one element. And if I were to go on my ratings, that 0.5 star would have probably been the side character performances. So that would be deserving of 0.5 star for me.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, it's interesting that we don't plan these episodes out in the sense of like, what I put on the list for what's next and what you put on the list. But sometimes they start like coinciding and almost having like a symbiotic relationship. You said that this film feels like it should have been a lot more mature, maybe European, maybe some like French farce. Well, shit, man, the movie that I'm bringing next week is exactly that times 10. And I apologize in advance, but I had to do it. I'm bringing Stanley Donen's, yes, Stanley Donen, the director of Singing in the Rain, his 1980 film, Blame It on Rio, starring Michael Caine and Michelle Johnson, Demi Moore, Joe Belloni. Have fun, and we'll see what happens.
I'm excited for this one, so I can't wait for this discussion.
Okay, well, I can't say that I'm not excited, but I'm also very, very familiar with this movie. And I knew what I was doing to myself by putting it on the list. So we're going to see what happens. Anyway, everyone, thank you for listening. Let's take care of some business first. Number one, I keep forgetting to mention, we have a sponsor, Bulletproof Coffee. Go to the Bulletproof website and in your shopping cart under promo code, put in B, the number 2B, to get 20% off your order. So please order some coffee for us. Also, listen to my other show, the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast. Find all my blogs, reviews, and pretty much anything I've done cinematically at thecultworthy.com. And you can find my friend Justin over on The Movie Wire at
themoviewire.com.
Like we always say, if you've got a suggestion for us, please let us know what movie you want us to cover. As long as it was covered by Siskel and Ebert on their television show, we're game. Hurt us. I want you to hurt us. I want you to, I mean, they've already brought Godzilla 1985 to the show. I want something powerful. We're not going to put shit movies on the list. I know we're not. We might once in a while for fun, but there's some stinkers out there. I want you to hurt us. I put the challenge out now.
It's going to be hard to top Godzilla 1985, and I challenge anybody that tries.
It's been great, Justin. I'll see you next week.
See you next week.